This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions change their careers, what relationships influenced their work. This week, conservation, a subject I'm deeply committed to. My guests today are passionate about protecting two very different locations. Rob Snyder helps island and remote coastal communities in Maine adapt to changing environmental and economic factors. But first, I sit down with Andrew Berman, the executive director of the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. Berman goes after the big dogs in New York City real estate, like NYU and Donald Trump, and he and his team can count many victories. Under his direction, the Society secured landmark protection for over 1,000 buildings. I wanted to know about his biggest heartbreak, the building that got away. I expected him to bemoan the upcoming expansion of the Chelsea Market, pushed through by Christine Quinn, former Speaker of the New York City Council and mayoral candidate. But I got a very different response.
You know, this is going to sound sort of strange, but one of my personal favorites that we lost was this beautiful building called the Tunnel Garage, which, believe it or not, was a parking garage, which you would never think who would care about a parking garage. It was one of the first purpose-built parking garages in New York. It was this beautiful Art Deco building that had a medallion on it that was an image of a Model T Ford emerging from the Holland Tunnel, which hadn't even yet been built when this tunnel, which was built near the entrance to the Holland Tunnel.
Where was this?
This was on the corner of Broome Street and Thompson Street, so sort of at the edge of Soho, the South Village. Beautiful building. I mean, it really, if there's a parking garage anywhere on earth that people would rhapsodize about, it was this one. And it had been on sort of lists for years of a building to be saved. A developer came along and bought it and said, you know, I just want to tear it down and build a slightly larger condominium building here.
How many stories?
8 stories.
How many units?
I think about 30 or so, you know, a pretty bland, you know, sort of, you'd
not
never look at it.
Building.
You'd never look at it twice.
What's another example?
Well, here's one where sort of the opposite. There was a vacant lot at the northern end of the Greenwich Village Historic District, and there was a plan to develop it, which we had no objections to. You know, vacant lots are there to be developed. But the developer put forward a proposal for this 13-story curving, entirely glass-walled building in the Greenwich Village Historic District. And we thought, that's ludicrous. That would never be approved. What does right. that have to do with the Greenwich Village Historic District? The notion is new development in these areas should kind of fit the character. They don't have to mimic it. It doesn't right. have to be like
some
a faux townhouse. Some compatibility. The commission unanimously approved it, which we were really taken aback by.
What's one that was a tremendous victory for you? Where's something where you guys really fought and you scored?
I'd say one of the ones that we're most proudest of is the part of Greenwich Village south of Washington Square, what we often call the South Village, the part of Greenwich Village that everybody associates with, you know, the folk revival, the beatniks in the 1950s and 1960s, Bleecker, McDougal, that area, amazingly was not protected by landmark protections. Any of those buildings could have been demolished and replaced with pretty hideous.
The Venice Beach of New York.
Yes, very much so. After really 50 years of people trying to get that area landmarked, we were able to get it landmarked in two stages.
What did it take?
It took thousands of people really coming together and pushing the city. One part of it is we actually had to almost sort of blackmail the city. They wanted to get an area adjacent to that rezoned as basically a sort of a SOP to a developer, Trinity Real Estate in this case. And we pushed the city council to say, we won't approve the rezoning that you, the city, want unless you move ahead with this landmarking that the community has been asking for years. So we really kind of backed them into a corner. And we, to be honest, we sort of used election year politics as a bit of a cudgel. You know, people were trying to look like they were being friendly to the community. So we were able to make them do something that they had not wanted to do and had been unwilling to do for years.
What area do you live in yourself?
I actually live in Hell's Kitchen. I'm a bit further to the north. But I'm a lifelong New Yorker.
Right.
I've worked in the Village.
You grew up where?
I grew up in the Bronx, but I've been working in the Village and on the west side of Manhattan since for over 20 years.
And where did you go to school?
I went to Bronx High School of Science.
Right.
So I've lived in New York my whole life.
What about college? Where did you go?
I went to Wesleyan University.
What did you study?
Art history with a focus on architecture and urban planning.
Talk about, if you would, what happened to Christine Quinn with the Chelsea Market.
Mm.
Because if my understanding is correct, that was in her district.
Yes.
And I want to be very clear that during that political race, I endorsed de Blasio and worked for de Blasio and did not support Quinn. And this is not, you know, to bash Quinn at all, but describe what happened in that Chelsea Market thing and what you think was going on,
sure,
the pressures that were on her.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, Chelsea Market is this old industrial complex built by Nabisco in Chelsea.
That it was a Nabisco factory.
It was a Nabisco factory. It was where the Oreo was invented.
Yeah, it was a bakery.
Yeah.
And who developed into the current Chelsea Market? How long ago?
It was originally another group of people, including a guy named Irwin Cohen, and that was in the late 1990s. It had been sitting there basically abandoned, and he came up with this idea that everybody thought was crazy at the time because this was a real backwater 15 years ago, of turning it into this huge retail
mall.
Market,
yeah,
with offices and things like that.
I mean,
above.
Like the gourmet food equivalent of a shopping,
yes,
mall. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was wildly successful. You know, the neighborhood around it transformed. It's a huge building. It's a, yeah, beautiful old building, but it's a huge building.
And they have air rights up above?
They did not have air rights up above. And that's where the key comes in with this. So they wanted to build basically two towers on top of this lovely old building, but they couldn't because they had no development.
On top
rights.
Of the 8 stories that are already there?
On top of the building that already exists.
Oh my God.
So they came to the city and they said, we want you to rezone us to give us these
How
development
How many stories
rights.
Did they want?
They originally, it was going to be, the addition was going to go up to something like 250 feet in the air or something like that. I mean, huge. And one on the west end, one on
That's
the
like
east
20
end.
20 stories.
Yeah. Yeah, huge building, huge building. And, you know, at this point, Quinn had already kind of shown herself to be very willing to be accommodating to developers. So we knew this was going to be an uphill battle at best, although Chelsea was where she was from. And a lot of the people who were very adamantly opposed to it were people she'd known and worked closely with for years. We were opposed to it as well. And she did eventually approve it. A slightly scaled back version made it a little less bad.
Has the work started already?
No, and it's not been clear to us why they haven't moved ahead yet, but they have all the approval, so it's really up to them to go anytime that they want. But this was definitely a disappointment. And what was particularly disappointing was that there were commitments that were quote unquote made as part of this approval about how it would have to remain all independent businesses. There couldn't be chain stores and all these other kinds of things, which it turned out none of these agreements were enforceable. It was really just sort of window dressing to this approval that the city gave them. And that's disappointing when you see things like that happen.
When do buildings need to come down? Things have to change, and we need to make room for more people.
Sure,
is that a reality for you?
Oh, it's absolutely a reality. And, you know, we would
Where did you acknowledge that one you wanted to save ultimately didn't need to be saved?
I'll give you an example. There's areas of our neighborhoods where we've fought for new zoning that we thought would encourage good development as opposed to bad developments, which meant the expectation was things will get built.
Give us an example of an area where this came into play.
For instance, in the East Village, we, working with a coalition, were able to get almost the entire East Village rezoned. So the old zoning would have encouraged big, tall towers. It would have encouraged building things like dormitories and hotels, believe it or not.
But isn't NYU, that's where NYU went to build a lot of their dormitories, didn't they?
Along 3rd Avenue and that area, yes. And we didn't want to see NYU take over the East Village. So we pushed for and got a rezoning that said, yes, there can be new development here, but the size and scale of it is going to be more like what you think of the East Village. 7-story buildings, 6-story buildings. This is what zoning does. You can get these what are called contextual zoning districts that says you can build, but to a certain height, certain number of square feet, things of that nature. So we've seen a lot of developments go up in the East Village under this new zoning that are so much more in character with the neighborhood than what would have been built under the old zoning. So we weren't pushing there to say no new buildings or nothing can ever be torn down, but that there should be new buildings, but it should really reinforce the character of the neighborhood. Just around the corner from our office, there was a huge parking lot that was just built on with an 8 or 9 story building. Right next door to it is a dorm that NYU built a couple of years earlier that's 26 stories. There have been quite a few new buildings closer to the traditional campus, but this will be a whole additional campus for the university.
Do you feel like the city, you turn around one day, you know, we have another subway tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
We have water tunnels that are coming in. I mean, the city is constantly, constantly, constantly being changed.
Right.
And if you had one wish, I mean, I'm sure you have a laundry list of things. What's one wish of how you'd like things to change in the next 20 to 30 years?
You know, I mean, I think the biggest pressing issue facing New York is ensuring that it stays a place that's affordable and accessible for a broad range of people. So I'd say if I had one wish for the city, it would be that somehow we could, it could be a place where, you know, sort of the most successful, you know, innovators and zillionaires can live there, and poor working folks and middle class people who are, you know, sort of raising kids or starting out or living on their own or sort of whatever, and everybody in between, you know, the immigrants, the longtime residents.
And you see some of the steps that were taken mm-hmm. to allow for that, like Mitchell Llama, that's
yes.
dying.
Yeah,
and these buildings
totally
are
dying.
All being, yeah, that's,
I
which is
grew
tragic.
Up in Mitchell Llama housing, and it's tragic.
For those who don't know, who are listening, that don't know what Mitchell Llama housing was, this was an attempt back then to have the city develop property where developers would build affordable housing and manage it as affordable housing. I'm being very shorthand with this. And manage it as affordable housing for a given period of time, like 30 years
right.
or something.
Right.
And then after a certain period of time, it would slowly devolve, if you will, evolve into private housing. They would mm-hmm. sell it as condominiums. And right now we're hitting that place where
especially in Manhattan, very few of them are left.
A lot of the Mitchell Llamas rolling over now to private condominiums.
Yeah, which is really changing the city.
But New Yorkers have resigned themselves to the fact that affordable housing itself, just like payphones, is a thing of the past.
Yeah.
And now more and more people who never dreamed of going to Long Island City and to mm-hmm. Astoria and Brooklyn is just a part of Manhattan now
mm-hmm. sure.
in terms of how many people who live and work there and put their kids in school there but who work in the city and commute. More and more and more people have resigned themselves or even are happy mm-hmm. to commute.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your experience as well?
Yeah. And, you know, in some ways, I don't think it's such a bad thing that a lot of people who would have only considered living in Manhattan before now are living throughout the city. What I think would be a terrible thing is if Manhattan became a place that only the wealthy could live, and that more and more the other boroughs, that became the case as well. I'm not sure that I know what the answer is. I mean, clearly, if we had a different political environment, we'd have things like Mitchell Llama programs and other things to create and build affordable housing, saying this is an investment in our city's future. The construction is good. It creates jobs. The fact that we give good, affordable housing to people who we need to, you know, to be teachers, to be firemen, to be sanitation workers.
We don't have housing for those people.
Yeah.
You know, one of the first things that happened in New York years ago was the police were successful in arguing against the residency requirement because
mm-hmm.
they said, you can't force me to live here because I can't afford the rent here on a policeman's salary. So they did away with.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, this is a city where rather than build affordable housing for people right. like the police and have them invested in the community they live in, they all leave,
sure.
which makes them somewhat less invested, I think, in the community they live in, although many of them come from the city, it seems. We could do a whole hour about the power of the real estate development community and the landlords and so forth in this. I mean, they run the city.
Sure.
They run the city.
In so many ways.
And they run the city. I mean, what gets built, what doesn't get built. Guys like you fight them and win because public outrage and public passions about these things still have some power.
Right. Well, ultimately, government makes the decisions, and while certainly the people with money and access have enormous influence over them, the average people do because they vote. And if you exercise that strength that we have, and it's the only thing we have is the power of the vote, that's the way that we can affect these outcomes.
I want to finish with this. The society has an LGBT initiative for mm-hmm. some of the preservation. They do talk about that a little
sure.
bit.
Sure. New York, and especially the Village, really has such a wealth of sites connected to the LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, civil rights movements. I mean, The one that everybody knows, of course, is Stonewall, where right. the riots took place in 1969, which in many respects
the
sort of
Alamo
kicked off
of the gay movement.
Exactly. Right. But there's many other ones as well. I mean, just around the corner from there, there's Julius's Bar, where in 1966 there was this sit-in, or sip-in as it was called, the first planned civil disobedience for gay rights. At that time, few people sort of know or remember this, it was actually illegal to serve alcohol to someone who you knew was a homosexual. So it since made gay bars illegal. That's why they were all
God,
owned
by
the mob.
Every hotel Tennessee Williams ever stayed in, people were breaking the law.
I know.
He drank
know.
A lot.
Yeah. So as a result of this, actually, there was a legal case that more or less changed that.
I've got to put that in a movie. I love that.
Yeah. You know, back when there were very, very, very few places that gay people could meet, almost all of them were in places like Greenwich Village.
And this year, in late June, just a few days before New York City's annual Pride Parade, and after many years of behind-the-scenes politicking, Andrew Berman and his colleagues celebrated early. The Stonewall Inn won its New York City landmark status, making it the first site designated primarily for its significance to LGBT history. Take a listen to the Here's the Thing archives. I talk with another hard-working advocate, Josh Fox, the environmental activist whose film Gasland exposed the dangers of fracking.
They would say, oh, your water's fine, and then they would go and get them a glass of water to drink. So, all right, well, if you think this is fine for my mother to drink, then you go ahead and drink it, and they wouldn't drink it.
Take a listen at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Conservation isn't only about preserving urban sites, it's also about saving a way of life. Rob Snyder, president of the Island Institute, helps communities in remote coastal Maine thrive. I know a bit about fishing towns, having spent much of my life on Long Island. Pressures are different in eastern Long Island and rural Maine. Where I live, it's constant commercial development, but the struggle to survive as a working fisherman remains. Coastal Maine, as Rob Snyder explained, the situation is more remote.
1,200 people is the largest island community in Maine.
Which one?
Vinyl Haven, off of Rockland, Maine, mid-coast area.
And they take a ferry?
Yeah, you take a ferry out there. Yeah, you take a ferry.
Year-round?
Year-round, you can take a ferry. If you're on Matinicus, you have to take a bush pilot flight on Penobscot Island Air. Plane flies a couple times a day as long as the fog has lifted. And you can get
year round or just winter time?
Year round.
So there's no ferry service too.
There's a monthly ferry. So
God, but I want to go hang out with. Why are we interviewing those people?
So, you know, I think that interestingly though, the kinds of pressure you're talking about how to conserve place and conserve community in places where the land is finite and so finite, you know, you really have a huge challenge in balancing conservation and community.
Is there pressure to develop those islands?
There really isn't the kind of pressure you're talking about. What you see more so is as property values escalate, the year-round community, the people who have been there for many generations, are having a harder time holding on, being able to pay their tax bills and stay on the islands. Whereas you're seeing increasing pressure.
What's changed? Why is it harder?
Why is it harder? I think there's two things going on at once. I think you have Maine is, as you point out, it's got an iconic stature. The natural beauty of the place is absolutely stunning. And so it attracts people to the coast.
And more remote.
More remote, absolutely. People come there because they want to get away from.
Right. They don't want the shadow of New York, which on Long Island you get.
They don't talk too much about Long Island. They talk about the Cape and other places they want to get
away
from.
You don't have Tiffany in Maine on Matinicus, do you? Do they have a Tiffany?
No, they have
not even a Tiffany outlet store? Okay.
If you want to shop, you do not go to a Maine island. You also have pressure because so much land has been conserved over time. Because the Maine coast has been a place for rustication for 100-plus years, you had people come in and conserve large amounts of the Maine coast. And so the communities that are left in these places often are highly constrained to raise additional tax money to function as a town.
Because a lot of the land is off the tax roll.
Frenchboro has 80% of its land conserved.
Were some of those families over the last 100 years, were they families we would know?
Or oh, of course.
For example.
Yeah. I mean, the Rockefellers had,
so the Rockefellers
the
had a presence up there as well.
Yeah, and to their credit, they put some land aside for future development when they made the large land transaction. What we're thinking about now is, because more and more people still, as they should, want to consider how to conserve their land if they're going to sell it off, or if the, you know, because generations are changing, the younger kids don't necessarily want the property anymore.
And they want the money.
They want the money. And they also are potentially able to put that land into a land trust. So what is the town going to do? Well, we're having a lot of discussions about how can you be really creative about conserved land so that you can actually contribute to the community's economy. So on Frenchboro, you know, they're looking at all options for...
For example?
For example, could you put a camping facility on some of that conserved land? And that's just one example. In other communities, this is a big tension on the coast of Maine. How much conserved land is enough is often the question. I think the kind of the better question is how can we take advantage of the economic opportunity that conserved land creates?
But back then when somebody would have a piece of land, let's say it's 1,000 acres and you have a compound somewhere and you pocket a few hundred acres, you pocket a couple hundred acres for your descendants and you're going to leave land to people to build houses in the future, sure, and then give away the rest. And now that's all kind of changed.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
right.
That's all changed in terms of land use and...
Well, and people are thinking about climate, like you mentioned, climate change. They're thinking about how can I use this land to actually make a difference in the place that I love. I've been coming here since a child. You know, maybe I want to put a solar array on this piece of land, or maybe I want to put a wind turbine on this piece of land. You know,
how's wind doing up in Maine?
I think it's doing well. The Island Institute worked with the North Haven and Vinyl Haven Islands off the mid-coast to build 3 wind turbines so that those communities could be energy neutral, right? They produce as much as they consume.
Right.
Alternative energy is radically, it's incredibly important, because unless we stop...
It's inevitable.
It's inevitable, but until we stop putting carbon in the atmosphere, sure, we're just going to destroy the ocean.
Sure. The acidity of the ocean is...
Yeah, I mean, it's just... It's off
coal
the,
plants
it's,
and
exactly.
cars.
Exactly. I mean, we're just... Maine, the Gulf of Maine is a gigantic sink for CO2.
Sure.
It's... I mean, we're seeing clams that are unable to build shell fast enough. Clammers who used to go fill a bucket with clams down in Casco Bay, which is off the city of Portland, you know, it's got a number of island communities there, they can't fill a bucket all the way anymore because it just crushes the shells. I mean, it's incredibly sad.
Change.
You know, in a time when the ocean is changing so much and you're seeing species move through your community, you're looking to diversify. You're trying to figure out, what does the future hold for me? What are my economics, right? And so you see fishermen starting to experiment with investing in oyster aquaculture or looking at kelp, growing kelp, you know, for Asian markets.
You're heavy into this fishing industry and this fishing.
Well, fishing and energy
conservancy
are huge.
And energy.
Yeah,
in
these
order
are
to
big
protect,
pieces of our work. I mean,
you're trying to protect communities and lifestyle.
I mean, the Island Institute is about sustaining island communities, island and remote coastal
it's
communities.
It's not just about conserving land.
It's really
and
not.
Preventing building on land.
No, I mean, when
That's
we started 30 years ago, there's no question that people, you know, we owned islands. We helped develop experimental models for how you could reintroduce sheep to private islands and how you could maintain pastures and how you could...
Do home builders have an alliance there that you have to contend with there?
No. I mean, we are viewed as a bridge, because that's ultimately...
So the people who do live in the community year-round, what do they do typically?
Well, you have a large service
fishermen.
Sector. Yeah,
right.
So large service sector, a lot of caretaking, a lot of...
Housekeeping,
we do have housekeeping, you know, transportation, ferry transportation. You have people who do telecommute. So we have increasing number of people who are working online from the islands in Maine. And I think that's an important part of the future, I hope. You know, I see that as being possible. Obviously, education, healthcare, the stuff you would expect. There's elder care facilities on these islands. There's beautiful schools, whether it's a one-room schoolhouse or a K-12 school, you know, they're large employers as well as the municipality, because we have, of course, a lot of local control in Maine. But then the vast majority, the rest of it's fishing, right? It's, you know, you go to a place like Vinyl Haven, you have 350 boat captains and their crews living on that island, right? You have 6,000 lobster fishermen in Maine. It's the last large, it's an incredibly small boat, but very large fleet fishery, right? So 6,000 of those guys, I think about 3,500 are actively fishing. Mm. You know, there's obviously folks who are retired and too young to be full-time, but, you know, that's a big that's a big piece of the economy. That's why you hear me talking so much about this. Affordability is a big piece of it. We've made a lot of headway on that in recent years. A lot needs to still be done, but the average island income can only afford one half of the average island home price, right? So you, if you're a teacher and you're married to a fisherman, you're increasingly unable to afford a home in your own community. And so we're very focused on how
very common where I live as well.
How do you transition? How do you help people?
All the kids that left and went to college, they came back, they couldn't afford a house.
Yeah, so how do you help people transition in? But one of the big things that we're doing in Maine right now is investing a lot in kind of the infrastructure, the processing of seafood, the processing of lobster. How do you get enough capacity online to handle, you know, we caught 125 million pounds of lobster last year and off the coast of Maine. A lot of it's getting processed over in Canada, right? And so we're moving those, trying to move those jobs to Maine.
It was cheaper up there.
It was cheaper up there.
Well, and now you're going to make it cheaper down here?
That's right. That's the idea. But then there aren't many people who want those jobs.
They don't want them.
They don't want to stand in the cold and pick lobster.
Where are you from?
I'm actually from Cleveland, Ohio. From the east side of Cleveland. Right. Yeah.
And you grew up, what'd your dad do?
Dad's in insurance and my mom was a nurse. And Cleveland was a great place to leave.
Sure. A good place to leave. I was going to say, oh my God, you got me there. I love Cleveland.
Yeah, well, I've come to love it a lot more since I left. I mean, it's interesting. It's become a really cool place.
It's a great town.
I kind of grew up with the, you know, the river on fire and the, you know, the terrible stuff in the lake.
Cuyahoga.
Yeah, and it's all turned around. I had a hard time growing up there only because it felt like anywhere USA.
And you left, and where did you go to college?
I went out to Colorado, Colorado State.
Now, why there? Because you wanted just the opposite. You wanted fresh air.
I had a transformative experience with Outward Bound. I was able to learn mountaineering skills.
So you're an outdoorsman.
That's
like the fresh air and getting outside.
Yeah, absolutely. So I went out west and— You know, but I've always, you know, I thought I was going to run bike shops. That's what I thought I was going to do. I loved mountain
biking. Or if you were
biking.
In Colorado now, you'd have a marijuana bike shop.
I would have. I very well might. I'll let my brother know that's an option now. I have family out there now, and I loved living out there. But again, you know, I got married. My wife's family's back here in New Hampshire. And, you know, we wanted to live near family, near the ocean, and get to know the coast of Maine.
You were in Colorado how long?
I lived in Colorado for 10 years.
Wow.
And
what was part of the decision to leave there? It sounds, whenever I go to Colorado, if you are an outdoors type, it's just Eden. It's just so beautiful.
It is.
When you wanted to leave there, you wanted to be near water?
I left because I was looking for real community. I felt like the Front Range of the Rockies was being overdeveloped and exploited, and it was horrible. It was a place I didn't want to live in the future.
Exploited for what?
For available water, for thoughtless development. That's
what you didn't want to stay and fight that issue there.
No, I actually, once I got married, you know, it was really important to my wife to be back near her family, which is New Hampshire.
Okay, so she was New Englander.
Yeah.
You went somewhere before Maine.
It's true. I lived in Toronto. I lived in Canada for a while. And, you know, and I had thought for a long time, and, you know, this is one of these kind of crazy ideas you get at some point. You're just like, oh, I'm going to go live in China. And so I had this idea.
This is what I'm leading up to. Take me through this one.
Yeah, so—
Where did China go?
China came into it because I thought I wanted to get involved—
Because you were a communist.
I thought I wanted to get involved in international relations, and I thought that would be the place in the future where I'd be able to find work, getting involved with potentially helping the business community negotiate opportunities in China. I constructed this narrative in my head.
You wanted to do some business.
Without having any experience or resources to back it up. But it was just an idea.
I'm no different from you. I lay in bed at night thinking, what have I got that those Chinese folks want? What can I get over there and sell? What do I have?
What
DVD collection can I sell to the Chinese?
I went and studied over there as an undergraduate and got really interested instead in international development work. What really struck me, I lived in the southwest of China. There's 27 minority groups living in a province called Yunnan Province. Southwest China, it's south of the clouds is what the name stands for. And it's gorgeous. It's an incredibly environmentally diverse area. It's got everything from the Tibetan Plateau down to the Mekong River, all in the same province in one part of an incredible country. You know, in the readings I was doing in school, it was all about you know, these gigantic international aid organizations and international development organizations, they come in and they tell the locals what to do, right? And they take stuff from them and they tell them how to live their lives. And, you know, and I thought, people talk to each other. We're friends with each other. There's a way that money moves from USAID or Ford to a very local hill tribe on the border of Vietnam and China. I just wanted to go see it. I wanted to make some friends. And so I spent time exploring this, kind of how is the rural economy of China evolving as a result of international aid? And it was very, I guess, probably not very surprising. But to me, what I learned was in China, these minority groups were going to be wearing their costumes and dancing for time immemorial so that tourists could come and watch them and appreciate them, right? And I thought, this is the classic kind of tourism development. It's like the Disneyfication of culture. And I also saw that it was made possible because at every step of the way, relationships were created, deals were cut. It was not some invisible hand of international money coming in and changing people's lives. It was people changing their own lives in ways that maybe they wanted those consequences. I don't know, but I wasn't going to make a value judgment. And I thought, well, I could spend the rest of my life over here and not change a thing. I could never make a difference. Or I felt like it was going to be impossible to have an impact in this world if I spent my time over in China. And I thought, you know, and I had met my wife and I said, you know what? Let's go home. Let's go back to the U.S. and apply this energy and effort to trying to make the world a better place at home.
How long were you in China?
Oh, just for collectively a year, right? Not a long time. Okay. You know, not a long time. I was there to get a preliminary research visa.
And that was before or after Colorado?
This was after Colorado.
So 10 years in Colorado, then this little kind of...
spent a couple of years...
sojourn over to China.
Yeah, that was part of graduate work.
You
I was
knew
working
your wife wanted
PhD.
To go back to New England. Did you know when you were heading back to New England that this environmental-based work was what you wanted to do? Did you go there gunning for
that
kind of a job?
I knew that I wanted to work in the nonprofit sector. What happened was that colleagues of mine in Toronto were at a bar on Prince Edward Island when staff from the Island Institute were at the same bar on Prince Edward Island.
Okay. A lot of great things happen in bars.
Especially, in remote bars in Canada.
There you go.
And so they got me into the Island Institute. They said, you should check out this place. These communities are really incredible. The challenges they face are remarkably complex. And, you know, you've got this background, even though it's over in China, like what about taking the thinking about how do you do smart work to help communities sustain themselves? How do you take into account the limits on the environment? And how do you take into account the social cohesion of small communities? How do you bring those things together, those strengths that these places have to help make them sustainable for years to come? Right. To me, that was an incredibly compelling mission. When I came to Maine, I thought I'd left China behind. I thought there's nothing I'm going to see on the coast of Maine that's anything like China.
And,
you know, what I found was kind of surprising, right, that if we wanted to get involved in preserving a commercial fishing wharf so that fishermen could always go down to sea to make a living. And the only way to conserve that wharf was under the existing state statutes around land conservation. Scenic beauty, cultural importance, you know, open space.
What
nothing,
I was describing, the limitations I was describing.
Yeah, farmland, you know, like forest land.
There are requirements.
Yeah, there are requirements, but none of them applied to fishing, right? That, you know, like you figure, we on our flag, we have fishing, farming, and forestry in Maine. And farming and forestry have these land protections. There's nothing there to preserve access to the ocean for fishermen. And so that first piece of land, and I don't want to take too much credit here, there were a lot of groups that worked on creating language that allowed that land to be conserved because of its scenic beauty. And because that was what was available. So the aesthetic coding written into that initial easement on that wharf, what does the architecture need to look like on that wharf? What kind of fisheries will be allowed to land there? I mean, you're having to design the future. And I thought, oh my God, like if we're not careful, we're going to have like the Disneyfication of the lobster fishery.
Right.
You know, like guys are going to have to wear their orange grundins and have lobster boats with certain lines.
Be smoking
and
a corn cob pipe.
Yeah. I mean, it just could be the worst of all situations. And so, you know, I thought that's exactly what we don't want as an outcome. I don't want to see what happened in China happen on the coast of Maine. So we changed the state's constitution actually to include fishing as a new category. When I think about what the future holds, it's, if we're successful, the coast of Maine will will really be a beacon for how we could live in this world, because people will understand how to live within environmental boundaries. They'll know how to live relying on each other, right? They're going to, and they'll be, and the coast of Maine will be connected. It's going to, technology will allow the coast of Maine to be sharing what it's learned. Practical adaptations to climate change will be able to be shared easily with similar communities anywhere. That, to me, is the opportunity.
For Rob Snyder, the current opportunity is to help Maine fishermen, both current and future, move beyond lobster as a source of income. He hopes there is money in kelp. He says it tastes great, by the way. And he is encouraging fishermen to add mussels, scallops, and oysters to their haul. This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio in association with Stony Brook Southampton Graduate Arts.